From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
But there's basically about 30 or so companies that specialize in carrying out these quasi-military functions.
Are the CIA, State Department, and Drug Enforcement Agency contracting with mercenaries to subvert Congress and fund secret wars in Latin America? Today, we'll look at four major companies involved in the privatization of the war on drugs. Also, newly declassified documents reveal the U.S. knew its intelligence sharing with the Peruvian Air Force would likely lead to the killing of civilians. In a conversation with Democratic Congressperson Jan Schakowsky, she's introduced a bill to end U.S. funding of secret armies in the Andes. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinians said Israeli tanks entered three areas of the Gaza Strip and shelled a police post today, a day after Israel announced it would observe a unilateral truce. Palestinian officials dismiss Israel's truce announcement as a public relations ploy and said calm can only be restored once Israel halts settlement construction. Hundreds of honey producers in beekeeper suits in Buenos Aires, Argentina, sprayed smoke canisters and waved banners yesterday outside the government house protesting a hefty new U.S. tariff on Argentine honey imports. The demonstrators, who set up hives with live bees on a downtown boulevard, maintained Argentine honey was being unfairly hit by a tariff in excess of 50%. The dispute has gained media attention since a decision earlier this month by the U.S. government to penalize Argentina for subsidizing honey production. Six people have been charged with the killing of one of Mozambique's best-known journalists. Carlos Cardoso, the founder and editor of an independent paper, was shot to death in the Mozambican capital, Maputo, last year. A businessman and a former bank manager were charged with contracting the killing. Cardoso wrote extensively about the country's largest ever bank fraud, in which the equivalent of $14 million was siphoned out of the Commercial Bank of Mozambique in 1996 on the eve of its privatization. A coalition of more than 100 non-governmental organizations, including Amnesty International, unions, environmental groups, and doctors, is calling for an investigation into the use of tear gas, plastic bullets, and arrests used by police during the protests in Quebec City in late April. They say the decision to fire tear gas at protesters came from executive members of the federal and Quebec governments. The inquiry should therefore look at the political forces or politicians who would authorize the use of such force. During the three-day Summit of the Americas, where 34 heads of state negotiated the free trade area of the Americas, over 400 protesters were arrested. A jury asked yesterday that ExxonMobil Corporation must pay $1.06 billion to a family whose land was contaminated with radioactive waste. ExxonMobil did not deny there was contamination on the land, which had been leased by a contractor for the company. The company disputed the amount of contamination, how much the cleanup would cost, and when ExxonMobil first knew there could be a problem. The family's attorney said ExxonMobil knew about the potential for contamination since the 1950s, but kept quiet in hopes of avoiding liability for cleanup costs. The jury ruled the company should pay $56 million for cleanup and $1 billion as punishment for not reporting the contamination. Air Force physician John Buck will not serve prison time for disobeying a direct order to take an anthrax vaccine before being deployed overseas. An 11-member panel of Air Force officers yesterday sentenced Captain Buck to 60 days of base restriction and fined him $21,000. He'll also be reprimanded. The panel did not rule on whether the vaccine was safe, only on whether Buck disobeyed an order when he refused to take it. The military insists the vaccine is safe and the best weapon against biological attacks. Buck did not offer any defense. A presiding military judge last week prohibited Buck from arguing that the anthrax vaccine is an experimental and possibly hazardous drug unlawfully forced on soldiers. And the Pittsburgh City Council voted unanimously yesterday to require many companies doing business with the city to provide workers with a minimum wage of $9.12 an hour. About 30 communities and a handful of cities nationally have adopted living wage laws since the first such legislation was passed in Baltimore in 1994. Finally, Vermont Republican Senator James Jeffords warned President Bush yesterday he's close to leaving the Republican Party. Senior White House aides and congressional sources in both parties said they expect Jeffords will do so and put control of the Senate in Democratic hands. Jeffords is a liberal Republican who's often at odds with his party, who angered the White House by breaking with the president on his tax cut plan. He met privately with Vice President Cheney and later with Bush at the White House yesterday. Jeffords said afterward he plans to make his announcement today. A switch by Jeffords will have a profound impact on the balance of power in Washington, giving the Senate a 51-49 Democratic majority and posing new problems for Bush's legislative agenda. It would put the chamber under immediate control of the Democrats for the first time since 1994 and give them all the committee chairmanships. We're joined on the phone right now by Chris Graff in Vermont. He's head of Associated Press Bureau there. Can you tell us how this happened, Chris Graff?
Well, Amy, it's been a long time coming. Some have said that it is something that just happened, but it really isn't. Jim Jeffords has been frustrated for all of the 5 months that President Bush has been president, as he has found out that George W. Bush is more conservative than Senator Jeffords had expected, and especially on some of the key issues that Senator Jeffords cares about, the environment, special education. The big break came over the president's tax cut bill. That is, as you know, the showcase of the Bush administration, and Jim Jeffords cast the decisive vote against the tax cut plan. So pretty much then the die was cast that there was going to be friction between Senator Jeffords, a veteran Republican, and the White House. And then in the last couple of days, it just became apparent that Senator Jeffords thinks that the Senate would be in better, would do better on the issues he cares about if the Democrats were in control.
Can you talk about the retribution he faced for the tax plan?
Well, that's, I think, what happened after the tax cut vote was that Jeffords said he didn't think there would be any retribution because the Senate is 50-50 and the Republicans and the White House need him every day in a Senate so evenly divided. But then it became clear that from leaks from the White House that the president was going to seek revenge. First, there were little things, like Senator Jeffords is the chairman of the Senate Committee on Education. The National Teacher of the Year was from Vermont. At a White House ceremony honoring her, Senator Jeffords wasn't invited. Then came greater leaks that perhaps the White House would take out its retribution by deep-sixing a bill that is extremely important to Vermont and Vermont dairy farmers. It's called the Northeast Dairy Compact. And so it was then, I think, that Jeffords raised this possibility that he would be fighting back by considering switching his allegiance. I think at that point it might have been a negotiating ploy, but then in the last couple of days it became a serious reality.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Chris Graff, head of the Associated Press Bureau in Vermont.
Here we come with our candy and our guns, and our corporate muscle marches in behind us. But freedom's just another word for nothing left to sell. And if you want narcotics, we can get you those as well. We help the multinationals when they cry out, protect us. The locals scream and shout a bit, but we don't let that affect us. We're here to lend a helping hand in case they don't elect us. How dare they buy our products and still they don't respect us.
Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la.
If you thought the army was here protecting people like yourself, I have some news for you, we're here to defend wealth. Away with nuns and bishops,
Romero.
The good Lord will help those that help themselves. I have some news to you, we're here to defend wealth.
Tra-la-la.
The Marching Song of the Covert Battalions by Billy Bragg, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Last month, a Peruvian Air Force jet shot on an anti-drug mission down a civilian plane carrying American missionaries, killing Veronica Bowers and her infant daughter. A U.S. intelligence aircraft piloted by private contract employees working for the CIA had been providing the Air Force with what it called real-time aerial intelligence to track suspected drug flights as part of U.S. counter-narcotics assistance to the Peruvian and Colombian military. After a storm of international criticism, the Bush administration suspended the CIA flights. But the question remains, what was the CIA doing helping Peru to shoot down civilian aircraft, and how did this policy emerge? Recently declassified documents reveal that the Clinton administration knew as early as 1994 that its proposed policy of sharing real-time aerial intelligence with Colombian and Peruvian military would likely lead to the killing of civilians and violate international law. But rather than scrap the policy, the Clinton administration mounted a public relations campaign to deny U.S. responsibility in the likely event that innocent people were killed. Michael Evans is director of the Colombia Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, a nonprofit foreign policy research group based in Washington, D.C. Michael, why was the shoot-down policy so controversial in 1994, and why was the debate over the issue so heated?
Well, we've obtained, through the Freedom of Information Act, declassified U.S. government documents pertaining to the policy debate that arose in 1994 when the Clinton administration, or within the Clinton administration, after the governments of Peru and Colombia announced their intention to use weapons against aircraft suspected of carrying drugs. The debate resulted at first in the suspension of real-time aerial tracking assistance to the two governments, that is, intelligence that is transmitted to the users in nearly real time, which is the kind of thing that they use to track aircraft and to shoot them down. But the suspension on real-time assistance was quickly lifted after vigorous opposition from within factions of the State Department, and especially from the U.S. embassies in Peru and Colombia. The documents that we have give a good sense of the priorities that the Clinton administration officials weighed during this episode and reveal that the more prescient minds, people who specifically warned that an incident like the downing of the missionary aircraft in Peru would be inevitable under such a policy, that these more reasonable people were overruled by policymakers bent on prosecuting the drug war by any means necessary.
Now, this is very significant that you got a hold of these documents. Why have they been unavailable until now, and how'd you get them?
Well, we obtained them using the Freedom of Information Act, and I don't remember exactly when they were declassified, but it was a year or two ago. And it's the kind of thing that comes into our collections that we see, and it looks interesting at the time, but, you know, really takes an incident like this to generate any interest in it.
How was the issue resolved by the Clinton administration, this issue of the shoot-down policy, them knowing that they're going to shoot down civilians?
Well, if I could just back up a little bit, it's important to remember that before 1994, the United States had consistently taken the lead in opposing the use of weapons against civil aircraft under any circumstances. The U.S. was, of course, strongly critical of the Soviet Union after the shoot-down of the Korean Airlines jet in 1983 and had been concerned about Cuba's occasionally stated intention to shoot at civilian aircraft. So, the reason that it was so sensitive in 1993 and 1994 after Peru and Colombia announced their intention to implement this policy was that the U.S. played such an intimate role in these operations. And the Pentagon was rightly concerned that their personnel could be held in violation of international law. So the Department of Defense, who were apparently also motivated by one of these so-called friendly fire incidents over Iraq in 1994, they unilaterally suspended the intelligence sharing program with Peru and Colombia that prompted this fairly intense debate. The policy bureaus and the embassies were outraged, arguing that the suspension would set back progress on counter-drug programs. But the State Department's legal advisor supported the suspension, arguing that, and I'll quote from one of the documents here, "mistakes are likely to occur under any policy that contemplates the use of weapons against civil aircraft in flight, even as a last resort." And apparently, they thought the circumstances had not changed since they had opposed, similar efforts in 1989 by Senator Mitch McConnell to have a similar policy for the United States. And it's clear that the international law was very clear on this. The Chicago Convention on Civil Aviation states that, quote, every state must refrain from resorting to the use of weapons against civil aircraft in flight, and that in case of interception, the lives of persons on board and the safety of the aircraft must not be endangered. And the legal advisor, his opinion was that, again, I quote, the nature of the international law prohibition is categoric. The prohibition applies whether or not the aircraft in question is suspected of engaging in criminal activity. So there's this fundamental prohibition of the shoot-down policy at work, and there were a lot of U.S. officials who felt that international law and the principle of due process were inviolable. The trouble is these people were ignored, and the drug warriors pretty much won the argument.
How did the Clinton campaign launch this PR campaign, knowing that civilians could be shot down, to cover that up?
Well, yeah, I should say the Clinton administration was under great pressure from Congress, including in particular a number of the traditional liberal Democrats like Senator John Kerry. But there were basically two problems, domestic law and international law. So they decided to simply change the U.S. law to allow U.S. intelligence to be used in foreign operations against these suspicious aircraft, while at the same time mounting this defensive PR campaign. And again, I'll quote from a State Department document, quote, to reduce the U.S. government's exposure to criticism that such assistance violates international law. The new U.S. law specifically authorized U.S. support for foreign governments to shoot down civil aircraft in cases of suspected drug trafficking, but also shielded U.S. personnel from any liability for actions taken in support of the shoot-downs. We can really only speculate what measures were taken to shield, to reduce the U.S. government's exposure to criticism that the assistance violates international law. But clearly there was an intention to do so, and several of the documents indicate.
Michael Evans, if people want to see these documents, where can they go online?
Our website is www.nsarchive.org.
I want to thank you for being with us. Michael Evans, director of the Columbia Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, got these documents under the Freedom of Information Act. When the Peruvian Air Force downed a plane carrying the American missionaries last month that killed Veronica Bowers and her baby, it was a U.S. plane piloted by private contract employees of the CIA that provided them with their intelligence. Since the 1940s, the CIA has used private companies and even front companies owned and operated by the CIA to provide plausible deniability and hide some of its most sensitive operations from congressional oversight and U.S. law. Throughout the 90s, these companies, often staffed by former military officials and CIA employees or ex-employees, have helped to mask growing U.S. military involvement in Latin America. And today we're going to look at the four companies, at least four of the companies, working with the U.S. government to privatize the drug war. Increasingly, the U.S. government contracting with private American firms to carry out quasi-military functions. We're joined now from Bogota, Colombia, by Juan Tamayo, who is the Andean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Can you lay out what this practice of, well, what critics call the hiring of mercenaries is, and the four companies that you focused on in your piece?
What's happened was that in the 1990s, the U.S. military began shrinking very radically. There was an increasing sense in Washington that we did not want to be involved in foreign hotspots, and coupled with the trend towards sort of privatization of all kinds of public functions, there was a rise in the use of private contractors to carry out what had been, what are, quasi-military functions. I think the Pentagon now has something like 700,000 part-time consultants and contract workers, but there's basically about 30 or so companies that specialize in carrying out these quasi-military functions. Most of it is sort of logistics support, airframe, aircraft maintenance, teaching foreign armies how to develop their own doctrine, how to train their troops, how to set up a defense ministry, and obviously how to manage or work some of the more sophisticated equipment that has that is being used in the field of defense these days. The downside, there's many arguments surrounding the use of these people. One is that some of the U.S. agencies carried charged with carrying out some of the programs simply don't have the sort of competence to carry out those programs. For example, for some reason, it is the State Department that carries out most of the counter-drug programs in Latin America. There's an office within the State Department called the International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Bureau. They get the bulk of the congressional money for counter-drug programs in Latin America. And obviously, the State Department doesn't have a lot of pilots. The State Department worries about things like embassies and everything else. They don't know specifically how to run crop duster airplanes that are used to spray weed killers on the coca crops, those kinds of things. So those kinds of specific functions then are hired out. There's any number of companies that are doing these things. There's sort of four big ones in Latin America right now. The biggest one is DynCorp. It basically runs the State Department's Air Force, which is called the DOS Air Wing. It probably has something like 40, 50 airplanes, helicopters in Latin America in support of the counter-drug mission. And it's, by any standard, it would be, you know, one of the larger sort of air forces in Latin America. So DynCorp runs most of that, a big chunk of that. They provide helicopters.
We're talking to Juan Tamayo. He is the Andean correspondent for the Miami Herald in Bogota, Colombia, and we'll come back to him in just a minute here on Democracy Now! You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Juan Tamayo, Andean correspondent for the Miami Herald based in Bogota, Colombia, talking about the privatization of the drug war going through the four major companies that do contract work with the U.S. government. Many call them mercenaries. DynCorp is what you were just talking about, Juan Tamayo. How many pilots, mechanics does DynCorp employ?
In Colombia right now, I think it's about between 70 and 80. That includes everything from the pilots of the spray aircraft that are used to fumigate the coca fields, the mechanics that maintain those airplanes, the pilots of the armed helicopters that provide security for the spray aircraft, and a special helicopter that's called a search and rescue helicopter, which sort of oversees the entire package and kind of jumps in when anybody needs any help.
We've interviewed many Colombians who talk about the problems of the defoliation of the coca fields with people getting ill from the pesticides, etc. What responsibility does this contracted out or outsourced firm have for the public health?
Well, it's not just the issue of public health. This is one of the great question marks that surrounds the entire outsourcing program, which is what constraints are put on them? What responsibilities do they have? If something goes wrong, who pays for the broken dishes? There's a lot of questions as to under what kinds of conditions these people operate. For example, the regular U.S. military in Colombia cannot go out on operations with the Colombian military or the police that may result in any sort of combat. On the other hand, the Dying Corps crews, specifically the search and rescue crews, their job is to basically jump into a hot situation, and whether that is an accidental crash or a firefight, that's what they're contracted to do. So there's all of the contracts with the State Department and with the Department of Defense are not public. So we don't, no one seems to know, basically, except the contracting agency and the contractors themselves, what kinds of restrictions are placed on the contractors when they get into the country.
You're talking, really, as you point out in your piece, about the hiring of mercenaries, and the U.S. government is doing it.
Well, you know, in my talks to a lot of the people involved in the contracting dispute, the word mercenary is pretty loaded because there are international treaties regarding the bans on the use of mercenaries. These people, 99% of them, are not contracted to perform any fighting duties per se. They're contracted to teach, to fly counter-drug missions, those kinds of things. So there's a real thin line there that the people who support the use of outsourcing prefer to call it outsourcing, and the people who oppose it think that this is close enough to using mercenaries to be bothersome to them and perhaps affect the international treaties in some way.
And mercenaries are illegal in the United States, is that right?
Well, I guess it depends on your definition of a mercenary. And apparently when the United Nations was trying to forge a treaty against mercenaries, banning mercenaries, particularly in Africa, they ran into all kinds of problems in the definition of mercenaries. A company like MPRI out of Virginia hires out sort of instructors, and these are business suit types. They wear a suit and jacket and ties, and they go into the defense ministry, and they tell them sort of how to set up a logistics system, or how to set up a training program, or how to write certain manuals. The definition of a mercenary gets lost in there somewhere. It's clearly something to be concerned with. It's clearly something that is a gray area right now.
MPRI, Military Professional Resources, Inc., based in Alexandria, Virginia, tell us who they're made up of and their role in Colombia.
Well, they're made up of retired senior U.S. military people, but also retired Defense Department people, State Department people, CIA people. Their role is to provide this kind of tutoring for foreign militaries. They've been very active in the Balkans. They worked with the Croatians. They worked with the Bosnians, and I think the Macedonians and the Macedonians. They also had a relatively small contract down here for about a year. They sent down 14 retired military people to help the defense ministry with issues such as logistics, administration, legal procedures, the broader types. These are people, again, as I said, that wore jackets and ties. They're not out there with wearing uniforms. They're not armed. And the idea was try to bring a little bit or rather increase the efficiency of the defense ministry, including the military and the police. Their contract expired March 8th, and it was not renewed. Apparently, there was money, there was U.S. money in the pot to renew the contract, but the Colombians felt that the work of the NPRI people apparently was not worthwhile to them.
We're talking to Juan Tamayo, who is the Andean correspondent for the Miami Herald, has a piece in yesterday's Miami Herald called Private Firms Take on Jobs, Risks for U.S. Military and Andes Drug War. The head of NPRI?
Yeah, the head of the NPRI is retired general Carl Verona, who was head of the U.S. Army during Operation Desert Storm.
You also write that... Go ahead.
And the sort of the leading officers are all of that caliber, former head of the Army in Europe, et cetera, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, at that level, very high caliber people.
As well as ambassadors.
Ambassadors also, exactly.
It sounds like a mini U.S. Army. You quote Congress members who are deeply concerned about this issue, not to mention military people, but someone like Jan Schakowsky, a Democrat from Illinois who we're going to have on the program, she wants to go the route of proposing a total ban on these contractors or mercenaries, whatever.
Well, I think this is one of the rare times, rare issues in which both the liberals and the conservatives in Congress are almost agreed that there's something wrong with the program that needs to be fixed. The main complaint, the main concern, is the lack of control over the activities of these people. American government officials in countries like Colombia are under a relatively well-detailed set of restrictions. You cannot do this, you cannot do that. It is unclear whether these contractors are subject to the same kinds of restrictions, thereby opening the question of can they do things that would be ultimately embarrassing to the United States, ultimately against the aims of U.S. policy. That would be one side of the argument against using these people. The other side, from the conservative side, also may be that we're paying a lot of money or contractors to do work that local forces could do. In other words, some of the money that perhaps is going to DynCorp to fly around the country and perform certain duties, should be taken over by the Colombian police or the Colombian military. The idea is you spend money not just in running these programs, but in training the local people, the Colombians or the Peruvians or whatever the case, in performing these functions so that eventually you can get out of the business and leave it for the local forces to manage the program.
Juan Tamayo, you talk about these four private firms that are doing the work that of the U.S. military, in a sense, DynCorp from Reston, Virginia, NPRI, Alexandria, Virginia. The other two you talk about are Aviation Development Corporation, which was involved in the killing of the U.S. missionary and her daughter in Peru, and AirScan of Rockledge, Florida. Can you briefly describe their roles?
Rockledge AirScan is a company out of Florida that owns several small airplanes equipped with infrared vision devices and long lens television cameras. They have been working in Angola and in Colombia, started out mostly in oil field security, sort of flying around and scanning the area for possible threats to the oil fields. In Colombia specifically, they work to protect the Caño Limón pipeline, which is regularly bombed by other leftist guerrilla groups here. I think in the last year they've hit it 60 times or so. It's I think it's been almost closed, the pipeline, in the last 3-4 months because of the number of attempts against it. According to AirScan's own webpage, they have also sold or leased one of these aircraft to the Colombian armed forces and trained some of their crews on how to use it. The other thing they do is they run some of the aerial surveys of coca-growing areas. Their cameras are pretty sophisticated, and I've been told they can tell the difference between sort of dead and dying and sort of on the way to dying coca bushes. So they use the air scan airplanes basically to survey the area and spot specifically where coca fields may be, and then that's followed up by the DynCorp spray aircraft that will spray the glyphosate on it. So this is a company that also does this in Angola. And besides that, it has some contracts with the, I think it's the U.S. Department of the Interior. They do things like a survey of national parks, then they'll count deer, wild horses, burros, those sorts of stuff. It is not just military use. A lot of these companies, in fact, have fair hand in some of the civilian side of these things. I believe DynCorp was involved in providing some of the computers that were used in the U.S. Census. MPRI runs the ROTC programs in about 217 U.S. universities. Some of these skills are quite sort of transferred to civilian situations.
And then there's the company that has brought these private contractors for the U.S. military under renewed scrutiny, and that's Aviation Development Corporation, involved with the downing of the plane in Peru that killed a missionary and her baby daughter. What is its role? Where is it based? Who's in it?
Well, we know very little about the company other than the fact that it has a CIA contract to operate some intelligence gathering airplanes in the region. One of the things that they became known after the shoot down of the missionary's airplane in Peru, they were the radar plane that guided they operated the radar plane that guided the Peruvian interceptor to the shoot down. However, I think one of the things that we found in doing all this is that these aircraft are not simple radar aircraft. They're not out there only to interdict suspected drug smuggling airplanes. They carry all kinds of electronics and can be used in any number of ways to monitor radio or telephone transmissions, to locate people on the ground, for example, kidnapped Americans or Americans who have been kidnapped in this region. We even had one senior intelligence official telling us that airplanes can pick up the emissions from the microwave ovens that are used to dry cocaine, the finished cocaine, the refined cocaine. I was told later that that was not a very effective way because of the jungle canopy above these laboratories usually sort of disperses the signals fairly well or disguises them. But they're used in all kinds of intelligence gathering operations, everything from trying to track drug shipments to the arrival of the chemicals that you need to process cocaine to trying to track down people who kidnapped Americans and trying to track down guerrillas who may be or may not be involved in the drug trade also.
Now, you say that it was a CIA jet that helped target the American missionary plane shot down by Peru, part of a secret U.S. government intelligence gathering program. The plane, though, itself was run by this company. Is that right? It was run by Aviation Development Corporation.
Well, in fact, I think the plane was owned by the Department of Defense. The plane, it's sort of tough to follow some of these things. The program itself is on the so-called black budget. It's part of the U.S. intelligence program, and therefore there's very little data on it. We understand that the plane was owned by the DOD, and that the Department of Defense didn't feel that it had the crews or the ability to carry out a small program like that. Therefore, they contracted at first they passed it on to the program, to CIA, and the CIA in turn contracted this company to actually carry out the flying and operating of the equipment aboard.
Interestingly, you quote a veteran of these counter-drug operations in Latin America talking about who's on these planes, saying, it's quoting, you know, who's on these planes.
Right. Some of the people that have been looking over the programs say that the contractors, regardless of how good or bad they may be, are not sort of sworn officers of the United States. They are not legal representatives of the United States. And this particular veteran of the U.S. military and some of the involvement in Latin America said he was aghast that none of the people on the CIA airplane involved in the Peruvian incident were sworn to defend the U.S. Constitution, had sworn an oath to the U.S. Constitution. He was very angry about that. In other words, they were all sort of unofficial people. He called them all rather negatively, all just businessmen. They were just people doing not bound by any of the rules of the U.S. government, per se. And again, this speaks to the major problem in this is exactly what controls are on these people. If they're in Colombia, can they go out? Is there a rule that says, no, you cannot engage, you cannot join the Colombian military in a firefight with guerrillas? Is there a rule that says that if you're in Colombia, no, you cannot make contact with guerrillas? Let's suppose that someone gets it into their head to try to broker peace in his own way. Is there a rule that says, no, you cannot do that? Is there a rule that says you cannot aid the right-wing paramilitaries that are operating in Colombia? So what are the restrictions on these people? It seems like at this point very few people really know, and the indications are that the restrictions are not many, in fact.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Again, Juan Tamayo is the Andean correspondent for the Miami Herald. He's speaking to us from Bogota, Colombia. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the issue of secret wars in Latin America and mercenary forces, congressional outrage over the killing of innocent civilians, the missionary and her infant, by the Peruvian Air Force, having been targeted by a CIA crew on a plane, has spurred increased opposition to U.S. privatization of the drug war. Congressperson Jan Schakowsky, a Democrat of Illinois, one of the leading progressive voices in Congress, has just introduced a bill to end U.S. funding of secret armies in the Andean region, and she joins us on the phone from Congress right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, can you explain the bill that you've just introduced?
I've introduced legislation that would prohibit the United States government from entering into any contract with private organizations or individuals, quote, to carry out military, law enforcement, armed rescue, or other related operations in the countries of the Andean region, including any operations relating to narcotics control efforts. essentially this says we can't enter into these kind of private contracts that lead us into secret wars.
We just finished a half-hour conversation with Juan Tamayo, who is the Miami Herald Andean correspondent in Bogota,
right.
Colombia, going through DynCorp and MPRI and the other private companies. Do you call these mercenaries?
I would say mercenaries is exactly the right word to use. It's interesting that actually Juan has more information than members of Congress are able to get. I talked to the CIA, and they wouldn't even tell me. They would neither confirm nor deny that private contractors were involved in the Peruvian shoot down, that how much money is being spent. It's all top secret. They won't tell us anything, which is your lead-in was congressional outrage. This was on both sides of the aisle from either end of the political spectrum. The most conservative to the most progressive of members are just furious about the lack of information.
So what kind of support do you have?
Well, how this is going to eventually play out is unclear, but I know that Dan Burton, who chairs the Government Reform Committee, is pretty determined to get at the bottom of it. He doesn't understand why that would be classified information. If we're using taxpayer dollars to fund these activities, if in fact they're legitimate activities, then shouldn't the American people know about it? So I'm hoping at least disclosure will be the end of it. In terms of support, I have a number of co-sponsors on the Democratic side of the aisle and intend to continue to push this legislation.
You're talking about so many ex-CIA operatives, former military men like MPRI being headed by retired General Carl Vuono, who commanded the Army during Desert Storm, ambassadors, former CIA officials. Can you really talk about these as separate from the government? Is it just a way of providing deniability for the U.S. government in these military actions abroad?
Well, I think that it may be. That's one of the questions that I asked, if it was to provide deniability. Are we trying to avoid public scrutiny, controversy, embarrassment? Do we want to end up hiding body bags from the media and shielding them from public opinion? I think these are all important questions that need to be answered. But to me, it's pretty obvious on its face. We're already spending $300 billion a year to fund the world's most powerful military. You know, how much more are taxpayers paying and why?
The name of the bill you've introduced, if people are interested in getting in touch with their Congress members?
The name of the legislation is the Andean Region Contractor Accountability Act, and the number is H.R. 1591.
That's the Andean Region Contractor Accountability Act, or ARCA, legislation that would prohibit the federal government from funding private armies in the Andean region. Jan Schakowsky, I want to thank you for being with us. I know you're just in the midst of caucus meetings and other congressional activities. Jan Schakowsky is a Congress member from Illinois, a Democrat. As we listen now about the U.S. companies that are involved in the so-called war on drugs in Latin America, we're going to hear from someone who's directly affected by the aggression. Edilsa Beltran is one of the spokespeople for the OFP, or Women's Popular Movement of Colombia. The OFP was formed 29 years ago to organize around education, health care, and employment. It's come under increasing pressure from right-wing paramilitaries in Colombia. The paramilitaries have just listed the head of the OFP a primary target for execution. Beltran is in the United States for the People's Global Action Bus Tour, which is currently traveling to cities on the East Coast, and will conclude with the People's Global Action First North American Meeting in Amherst, Massachusetts, June 1st. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!, Edilsa Beltran.
Buenos
días.
Soy una mujer de la Organización Femenina Popular de Barranca Bermeja, Colombia. Barranca Bermeja está situada...
Good morning. I'm a woman that's coming from the area of Barranca Bermeja, that I'm part of the OFP, OFP.
Barranca Bermeja está situada en el corazón de Colombia
Barranca Bermeja
y actualmente
is located in the heart of Colombia.
Es el corazón del conflicto.
Is
y somos
the heart of the conflict in Colombia.
Uno de los más afectados por la where invasion norteamericana por
one of the people who are the most affected by the United States intervention in Colombia, of all these companies that are coming to Colombia to foment war.
Sabemos que más de 6 millones de dólares al año son pagadas.
We know that more than $6 million are paid directly by the United States to these private companies.
Empresas que se dedican
companies that are
a bombardear los pueblos campesinos,
bombing peasants in the name of the war against drugs. They are bombing our land. They are displacing our peasants. They are displacing our people to live anywhere where it's rain with hunger in the middle.
Están sufriendo las consecuencias de la
guerra
contra
drogas. Children, they are suffering the direct consequences of the war on drugs. We also know that these mercenaries are coming through the city of Panama. They come as tourists into Panama, and the next day they are already in Colombia. And the Colombian government doesn't do anything. They don't denounce it.
¿Por qué queremos acabar con la gente de Colombia?
Why do they want to kill the people of Colombia?
La guerra contra las drogas no debe ser una guerra contra los pobres.
The war against drugs should not be a war against the poor.
Edilsa Beltran, the head of your organization, the OFP, the Women's Popular Movement of Colombia, has just been targeted for assassination by paramilitaries. How did you find out?
Nosotras fuimos declaradas objetivo militar por los paramilitares porque directamente lo anunciaron. Una compañera y un veedor internacional de brigadas internacionales de paz fueron abordados y amenazados.
An overseer of the peace process were directly told that we were a military target.
Por la denuncia que venimos haciendo,
the threats are given because we have been denouncing the human rights violations that are occurring around Barranca Bermeja.
You know, it's interesting to be able to hear you. And I think our listeners should know how difficult even it was for people to come into the United States for this tour, because originally the State Department denied visas to hear these alternative voices who are critical of the so-called war on drugs. And it took Cynthia McKinney's office inviting you privately and intervening to get a visa.
No solamente el gobierno de Estados Unidos está
not only the U.S. government has
la oportunidad de venir a denunciar
not only the people of the United States has given the opportunity to come and speak to them, but also the Colombian authorities. Also, the Colombian authorities have harassed us before leaving. They have taken us outside and they have asked us to check our bags, and we fought them, and we decided we want to fight them, and we didn't let them keep us outside, and we decided to take the trip.
Para tener todas estas cosas
and when that kind of things happen, we realize the links between the United States government and the Colombian government for keeping these things hidden.
We've just been talking about these four corporations, among them AirScan of Rockledge, Florida, sends airplanes loaded with surveillance gear and manned by U.S. military veterans to search for guerrillas in the jungles of Colombia. U.S. officials in Bogota said AirScan's Cessna 337 Skymasters use infrared and television cameras to spot guerrillas near the Caño Limón pipeline in eastern Colombia, bombed some 60 times in the past year by the ELN. It seems very clear that these mercenary companies are being used in Colombia to go after guerrillas, which is also separate from the drug war, just involves the U.S. in a war in Colombia. Do they go after the paramilitaries, which are most known for the violence?
As I was telling you at the beginning, the war in Colombia in drugs is a war against the people. The fields are bombed. Those who are dying are peasants. Those who are facing each other in the war are the children of the poor people, the poor women. The paramilitaries that are fighting are bought off for a salary because they need money, because they are hungry, they are in misery. They are forced to go into the military forces. The guerrillas are recruited the same way because they may get some salary. They may solve economic problems that they have, and every day they are dying one way or another. The war is really against the poor. We just want the opportunity to have social opportunities and economic opportunities. While hospitals are being closed every day, people are dying on the fields. We don't have education. We don't have public education. And a series of problems that we live in the area and the aid that we receive from the government, that everything can, is just weapons to kill people.
In this country, what do you think people can do? There is not very much awareness of the level of involvement of the U.S. military in Colombia.
Porque la gente en Estados Unidos no sabe o está mal informada es
because
que
the people in the States doesn't know or is misinformed. That's why we are here on the People's Action Network to do this tour and to let people know what's really happening there, what are real, the real problems. Because who else who that asks that we know what are the real consequences of this war on drugs are? Who asked and asked the woman whose children are dying in this war are the ones who need to say and need to tell people what's going on and what the problems are in Colombia and the Latin American level.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Adilsa Beltran from the Women's Popular Movement of Colombia, here as part of a group of People's Global Action Bus Tour of people from Panama, Bolivia, and Colombia touring the cities of the East Coast, concluding with the People's Global Action First North American Meeting in Amherst, Massachusetts, from June 1st to the 3rd. For more information, you can contact email oneworldnow@att.net. That's oneworldnow@att.net, or go on the web at www.agp.org. And of course, you know that
we also have a phone number. The phone number is where you can get more information about the upcoming events where these people will be speaking. And in the New York area and in the Massachusetts area, it's 727-896-8224.
And translators are not usually known. Why don't you say your name?
Oh, my
name
is Schneider.
Such a great job. Well, thanks very much for being with us. And we'll be hearing more as we continue to bring you the voices of indigenous people who are at the other end on the ground when those planes are in the sky fumigating and dropping their weapons. Thanks for being with us. That does it for the program. If you'd like to email us, you can send mail to mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony 1857 Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. You can also call for cassettes of the program at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the sub-studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!